Thoughts. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, and Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Scientists have studied the full genetic information of more than 18,000 cancer samples. They found new information about the patterns of mutations or changes that could help doctors provide better treatment. Their study, which appeared recently in the publication Science, is not the first to do such a complete genetic study of cancer samples. But no one has ever used such a large sample size. Serena Nixanel of the University of Cambridge was part of the team that did the research. She said this was the largest cohort in the world. It is extraordinary. Over 12,000 samples in the study came from patients recruited by Britain's National Health Service. They were part of a project to study whole genomes from people with common cancers and rare diseases. The rest of the data came from existing cancer data sets. Researchers were able to study such a large number because of the same improvements in technology that recently permitted scientists to complete the map of the entire human genome. Andrew Futrielle, a genomic expert at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, was not involved in the study. He said the study gives scientists some knowledge of the destructive forces that cause cancer. Cancer is a disease of the genome, or full set of instructions for running cells. It happens when changes in a person's DNA cause cells to grow and divide uncontrollably. DNA is a substance that carries the genetic information in the cells of living things, like a human. In 2020, there were about 19 million new cancer cases worldwide. For the study, researchers looked at 19 different kinds of cancer in the human body. It identified 58 new mutational signatures, or pieces of evidence leading to the causes of cancer. Nixanel said researchers also confirmed 51 of more than 70 previously reported mutation patterns. Some arise because of problems within a person's cells. Others are caused by ultraviolet radiation, tobacco smoke, or chemicals. Knowing more of them helps us to understand each person's cancer more precisely, which can help guide treatment, Nixanel said. Genetic sequencing, the process used to study the makeup of a cell, is already being included in cancer care. It is part of the growing move toward personalized medicine, or care based on a patient's genes and specific disease. Now doctors will have much more information to draw from when they look at individual cancers. To help doctors use this information, researchers developed a computer program that will let them find common mutation patterns and seek out rare ones. Nixanel said doctors could suggest a treatment based on a special pattern. Futrielle said the data can also show doctors what tends to happen over time when a patient develops a cancer with a certain mutation pattern. This will help doctors give earlier treatment and hopefully stop the developing disease. I'm John Russell.
Scientists have identified some remains, or fossils, of huge ancient reptiles found on mountaintops in Switzerland years ago. The researchers' finding is a little surprising. The fossils are from ichthyosaurs, a very large animal that lived in water. But the remains were discovered many hundreds of meters above sea level. The Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology published the study on Thursday. It describes some rib bone and backbone fossils from two ichthyosaur individuals. One bone was about 21 meters long, the other measured around 15 meters. A tooth from a third ichthyosaur is also an important finding, says expert Martin Sander of the University of Bonn. He is the lead writer of the study. The tooth is particularly interesting because it could possibly, but unlikely, represent the largest animal to ever inhabit Earth, he said. The tooth is about 6 centimeters at the base and about 15 centimeters long, the study says. The fossils are around 205 million years old, the study found, dating them to the late Triassic period. The tooth came from a mountain near the Swiss city Davos. It suggests the animal was a good hunter that could kill other large animals for food. The ichthyosaur was the largest ever reptile that lived in the seas. They had long bodies and small heads. The fossils were found at 3 sites in the Swiss Alps during the 1970s and 80s, said Heinz Furrer, another study writer. Furrer is a retired scientist from the University of Zurich's Paleontological Institute and Museum. He was one of several students that discovered the fossils years ago. The remains are incomplete, making it impossible to confirm the exact kind of ichthyosaur that made the fossils. Most likely, the animals belonged to an ichthyosaur family called Shastasauridae. It includes the biggest known ichthyosaur called Shastasaurus. It was found in Canada and believed to be 21 meters long. Some researchers have proposed longer ichthyosaur lengths based on incomplete fossils. Until now, huge ichthyosaurs had not been known to have lived at the end of the Triassic period. Scientists had thought the group disappeared from Earth a few million years earlier. The blue whale has long been considered the largest animal to have lived on Earth. It can grow to 30 meters long and weigh close to 200 metric tons. But study writer Sander said more research on the Triassic ichthyosaur may renew questions about the planet's largest creatures. I'm Jill Robbins.
Child migrants often miss months or even years of schooling. This hurts their chances of escaping poverty and having safer futures. Ciudad Juarez is a large city in Mexico along the country's border with the United States. For thousands of migrants and their children, it is the last stop before they enter the U.S. In Juarez, they wait for that chance to cross the border. U.S. policies make some people wait in Mexico for their court hearings to seek asylum. A number of Christian-based shelters in Juarez work to serve the urgent needs of this population, including education of school-aged children. the shelters have partnered with local schools in the effort. The curriculum is not religious, but a strong belief in the good of education drives the programs. Teachers believe education will help the children socialize and find jobs wherever they find a permanent home. Teresa Almada runs Casa Colping through an organization supported by the Catholic Church. She said the migrant students get included in the educational system so they can keep gaining confidence. She added, it's also important that the families feel they're not in hostile territory. Victor Rodas is a 12-year-old student. His 22-year-old sister and guardian, Catherine, led him and two other siblings out of Honduras. The family fled after receiving death threats from organized crime groups. In Juarez, Catherine and her husband will not leave the safety of the shelter. But she praised its educational program, which provides bus transportation so her siblings can attend Casa Colping. They say the teacher always takes good care of them, plays with them, Rodas said. They feel safe there.
Many housed in their shelter fled from Central America. Growing numbers of Mexican families fleeing illegal drug trafficking groups are arriving too. For a while after the school program started in October, teachers asked parents to join their children in their classrooms to build trust. Among them was Lucia, a single mother of three children. She fled the Mexican state of Michoacán after drug traffickers took over the harvest and everything in their home. She asked to be identified by just her first name for safety. Education is important so that they can develop as people and they'll be able to defend themselves from whatever life will put before them, Lucia said. She and her family have been living there for 9 months. More than 30 children from Christian-based shelters around Ciudad Juarez attend Casa Colping. First to third graders gather in one classroom. Fourth to sixth graders meet in another. In the U.S., Victor hopes schools will be big, well cared for, and will help him reach his goal of becoming a building designer. If you ask the kids, their biggest dream is to cross to the United States, said teacher Yolanda Garcia. Many parents do not want to send their children to school in Mexico, where they do not plan to stay. Also, many public educators do not want to bring in migrant students. There is a fear of losing teachers if class sizes decrease when students leave suddenly, said Dora Espinosa. She is a school official in Ciudad Juarez. In addition to uncertainty, poverty and discrimination keep nearly half of refugee children from school worldwide, says the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. But the biggest barrier is insecurity. Threatened with violence by gangs, both in their hometowns and along the trip to the U.S., many parents are afraid to leave their children alone. The shelters address that by providing secure transportation for the children.
The migrant children have experienced a lot of trauma, educators say. Samuel Jimenez is a teacher at one of the schools. He said students will tell him they are there because they murdered my parents. They tell it in detail. Children don't cover anything up. But, Jimenez said, the moment they're here, we can take them out of that reality. They forget it. Other students arrive unable to read or write. We are faced with all kinds of falling behind, said Garcia at Casa Colping, but most of all, with a lot of desire to learn. They missed school. When you give them their notebooks, the emotion on their face, some even tell you how lovely it feels to learn. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all. Responsibility from all. A strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public approval ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. More people, and not just the wealthy, were investing in the stock market. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served 4 terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected 4 times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kent. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century and a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
Clinton discussed some of the issues that the country continued to face, including racial divisions.
The divide of race has been America's constant curse. And each new wave of immigrants gives new targets to old prejudices. Prejudice and contempt cloaked in the pretense of religious or political convictions are no different.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States and indeed the interests of people throughout the Middle East and around the world. Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to threaten his neighbors or the world with nuclear arms, poison gas, or biological weapons.
In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. The United States provided 7,000 troops for that force. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. The Dayton Peace Accords were named after Dayton, Ohio, the location of the Air Force base where they were negotiated. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a Memorandum of Understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. The Y Memorandum resulted from 9 days of negotiations at the Y River Plantation in Maryland. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. That meant no more need for presidents to have to ask Congress for temporary renewals of those trade rights. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe. Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended that presidency.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.